This podcast is brought to you by Bloomberg Law. For more information about our professional services for the legal industry, please call 212-617-6569.
If you read the press reports, it sounds like there was suspicion that there were some Goldman insiders who were leaking information about the deal. If that could be proven, if it could be proven that that was authorized in some sense, then that might be considered a general solicitation.
Today we want to examine the legal issues surrounding the Goldman Sachs Facebook deal. The deal is done, but did Goldman bamboozle the SEC in the process? Joining us in studio for today's discussion is Merritt Fox, a Columbia Law School professor and NASDAQ professor for Law and Economics of Capital Markets. Welcome, Professor Fox, and thank you for joining us today.
Thank you.
Okay, so let's begin by discussing the deal as first reported on January 2nd. What details were leaked about the private offering?
Well, what we knew was that Goldman Sachs had itself invested $450 million, that they had acquired additional financing of another $50 million from a, as I understand it, Russian-based company, Sky Digital Technologies, and that they were looking to raise another $1 billion or so in a private deal to wealthy customers both in the United States and abroad.
And it also had set a valuation for $50 billion for Facebook. And with respect to the valuation, did it seem fair or does it seem fair based on what we now know of the company's financial performance in 2010?
Well, that's really hard to say. What we do know is that that Goldman Sachs felt that $450 million was a fair price for the percentage of shares that they purchased, and that's where the $50 billion calculation came from. Goldman is a pretty savvy investor, so one wouldn't think they were going to overpay. The figures for the earnings of Facebook for the first 9 months of 2010 was, I think, in the order of $350 million. Paying $50 billion for a company with $350 million a year of earnings seems pretty high. Obviously, what's implied behind that by anybody who would be willing to pay on a pro rata basis $50 billion is an expectation of very substantial growth in revenues over the next several years.
Okay, so tell me this. Did Goldman suffer a setback last week when it announced on Monday that it was restricting the offering to non-U.S. investors because, according to the firm, the level of media attention might not be consistent with the proper completion of U.S. private placement under U.S. law?
Well, I think you'd always rather be able to deal with more people than fewer. They'd raised the issue, obviously, the offer with many of their valuable domestic customers. Some of them presumably were interested, so they would be disappointed in not being able to participate. So from that point of view, I'm sure Goldman would have preferred if they had been able to go ahead and offer this to their domestic customers as well as their customers abroad.
And we should note that on Friday, Facebook announced that it had raised $1.5 billion, which was inclusive of, what, the $500 million?
That's right.
Plus a $1 billion offering to the non-U.S. investors. But I want to get back to Goldman's statement for just a second, though. What law or law specifically was it referring to?
Well, this was not a so-called registered public offering, the kind of procedure you'd do if you were doing an IPO, which involves a very detailed set of public disclosures and rules about the timing and marketing of the security. This was a private placement of securities. And those can only be conducted under certain rules and circumstances. And the three important characteristics are, one, that In large, it only can go to so-called accredited investors, who are individuals who are presumed to be sophisticated because of their income level or net worth. Secondly, that there are restrictions on resale. And third, that there not be a general solicitation in connection with the offering.
So although that Goldman and Facebook, they didn't disclose any information about the transaction, publicly, leaks from one or perhaps even both of the companies created this really intense media frenzy. And could that have been perceived by regulators as advertising or hyping the deal, thereby violating the third option that you just said?
Well, Goldman must have been nervous about that. We don't know exactly what the SEC said to them, what the nature of any investigation of this transaction was. But if you read the press reports, it sounds like there was suspicion that there were some Goldman insiders who were leaking information about the deal. And if that could be proven, if it could be proven that that was authorized in some sense, all big question marks, but if that could be, then that might be considered a general solicitation, because the idea of a general solicitation, one way you can do a general solicitation is to excite interest in an offer.
And then you also mentioned that the investors needed to be sophisticated, but what exactly does that mean? Who is a sophisticated investor under this regulation?
Well, it turns out millions of households in the United States are sophisticated investors
like
by these
really
criteria.
Low threshold, huh?
Maybe at least by, although the numbers are well in it, over the median in the United States, in sort of by Manhattan standards, maybe not so spectacular. So it would be household income, if it was an individual, of $200,000 a year. If it was a couple, it would be $300,000 a year, or net worth of $1 million, which of course could include housing, real estate, as well as securities investments.
And so, and it does sound like many of Goldman's New York clients, at least, would easily fit the bill for that. So.
Yeah, the press reports suggest that their minimum requirement for the group they were going to was a $10 million net worth, and that they that the minimum participation was $2 million. Obviously, you'd be well above this minimal accredited investor limit if you were able to come up with $2 million for participation.
Okay, and we should mention that unless a company or an underwriter uses a private placement exemption or some kind of other exemption, whenever they offer securities, doesn't the securities have to be registered with the SEC?
Yes, you basically start with the presumption that any offer has to be registered, and then there are exemptions, exceptions to that rule, and one of them is for private placements, and there are so-called safe harbor rules. In this case, what would have been used would be Regulation D, Rule 506, which says if you fall within these basic parameters that I talked about a moment ago in terms of the nature of the investor being an accredited investor, resale restrictions, and lack of a general solicitation, then the exemption is available and registration is not necessary.
When this exemption was really critical for Goldman and Facebook, because I think the issuance was twofold, was it not? On the one hand, you had Facebook shares coming from Facebook going to this SPV, the special purpose vehicle. But then on the other hand, you had from the vehicle to Goldman clients. So it seems as though the issuance would have been twofold in this instance.
Right. And there would, I think, be no question if we just stopped at selling, whether it's 500 million, a billion, or a billion and a half in Facebook shares to Goldman, that clearly is a private placement. So the focus would have to be on the second step, which was selling interests. But Goldman placed the shares in this special purpose vehicle, a limited partnership, And then the focus would be whether there was had been a public offering then of the interests in the limited partnership, the SPV.
Okay, and I want to turn now and talk about the number of shareholders that Facebook can have before it's required to start reporting financials and other information to the SEC. What's the rule here?
The basic rule is that once a company has 500 shareholders of record, then within 120 days after the end of the fiscal year in which that threshold is passed, it must start providing periodic disclosure to file periodic disclosure with the SEC. This is the 10-Ks, the 10-Qs, the 8-Ks, basically providing a wide range of information, including certified financials, to make them public.
And what's the rationale behind this requirement?
Well, the rationale behind the requirement is, in essence, it's like a proxy. The assumption is, well, if you have more than 500 shareholders out there, there's probably beginning to be a pretty active trading market in your securities, and to protect investors, the disclosure requirements are to provide people who are trading in this market with information.
Well, and to be clear, the company isn't required to go public, correct? It's just sort of, well, most private companies do prepare for an IPO once they reach this stage, but why?
Well, yeah, it is a distinction between being a public company in the sense of providing this periodic disclosure and having an IPO. The first is simply now you provide on a regular basis the same kind of information that well-known public companies like Ford or Intel or whatever provide on a regular basis. That's a separate question from actually making a registered offering to the public. And the first time you do that, that's called an IPO, an initial public offering.
And some people speculated, and I have to say that they were wrong. They thought that Facebook and Goldman were concocting some scheme by creating this single investment vehicle as a way to skirt SEC rules. But as it turns out, Facebook has announced that it will begin reporting to the SEC, I think, by April 30th, 2012. So tell me, though, why do you think they created the single investment vehicle?
My guess is that it related more to Goldman being able to control the market and who are the investors in, they were indirect investors, but the investors in this issuance of Facebook stock. They can set the rules about, you know, how long you need to hold them. They can, through this method, set restrictions on purchase and sale. They also can assure, we don't know the details of the agreement between Facebook and Goldman and the SPV, and in turn between the SPV and the investors, but they perhaps are assuring Facebook that only Goldman will be voting the shares, for example. So Facebook will management knows exactly who they're going to be dealing with in terms of any issues with shareholders. The representative of the shareholders would be Goldman, not the wide variety of individuals and institutions that hold interests in the SPV.
Well, instead of doing this private placement, why didn't Facebook just go public now?
Well, again, we're speculating, but there are a number of possible reasons. One is, if they went public now, they'd have to start disclosing a great deal of information that they have not been disclosing and apparently will not be disclosing until the spring of next year, so not for another 14, 15 months. It may be that during that period of time, their business model is maturing, they're changing things, and they really would, this is a critical period where they would put a special value on being able to keep more information private. Secondly, an initial public offering requires a lot of time and effort on the part of top management of a company. And this may not be the moment that is best for this group. Again, if the company is more mature, it's more settled on its business model and so on, the executives can like take their eye off the road for a minute mm-hmm. and you know, think about the IPO.
Yeah, I did read that where some analysts said that at 26, Mark Zuckerberg probably wants a little bit more time or as much time as he can get to mature as a leader before going public. And also, I heard that he's a fan of this freewheeling culture that he has there at Facebook, so maybe they want to maintain that for as long as possible.
Well, it is different running a public company than a private company. The sensitivity to the needs of even small shareholders mm-hmm. who you don't know but who could sue you under the right circumstances is different. And so it's frankly easier to run a privately held company than a publicly held company.
And since I've got you speculating, can you tell me, do you think Facebook's going to offer an IPO next year?
I only know what I read in the papers as much as what you read, Spencer. But what we do know is once they are providing this periodic disclosure, the 10-Ks, the 10-Qs, the 8-Ks, and so on, they're already revealing a lot of information about themselves. And so at that point, the extra information they have to reveal to do the IPO is much less. So, in some sense, the costs of that loss of privacy goes way down once they become a public company.
Okay. Well, and the last legal issue that I want to talk about today is really Goldman's role as an investment advisor. It has the fiduciary responsibility to know its customer, which means what exactly?
Well, it really means knowing what the particular needs and perhaps financial vulnerabilities and knowledgeability of its customers is. I think, again, from what we know about the customer list of people who were approached with in this deal, most of these, just by the fact that they have the $10 million available, would fit into that category. Sometimes there are institutions that have substantial amounts of money, but that are led perhaps a nonprofit institution or a municipal pension fund or a county treasurer or whatever might have some funds to invest where, despite the fact that somebody has a lot of money to invest, the people who are running those investments are not sophisticated, and that could become relevant. I'd be surprised if that's an issue in this case, though.
Okay, and with Goldman's investment here, would it be allowed under the Volcker Rule? Now, I know the rule doesn't take effect until next year. I believe it's July 2012, but would this investment be okay under it?
I think so. First of all, there's kind of a floor at which the Volcker Rule kicks in terms of how big this investment is compared to a company's Tier 1 capital. And this is well within that range. Secondly, this is not a hedge fund investment. This is presumably relatively long-term investment in a single company, the type of thing that investment banks have traditionally done for time immemorial.
And I have to believe, though, that if Congress had passed the stricter version of this rule, that it might have barred this investment. But due to vigorous protests by the banks, Congress decided not to adopt the stricter version. And we only have just a few minutes left. And during this time, if you could please explain why some retail investors have described this deal as unfair, even though, as we've discussed today, it appears to be legal. But many people have this sense of unfairness when they talk about this Facebook deal. Why is that?
Well, look, lots of people are excited about Facebook right now. It's about sort of as hot a company, I guess, as there is. It's very clear that something's happening where they are getting a significant increase in sort of the nation's advertising budget and in a whole new venue that they have a seeming near monopoly on at the moment. So there's lots of excitement. So I think those kinds of situations cause people to want to get in, be part of the game. Mm-hmm. And whether they're really losing out that they can't get in right now is a different question. But, you know, people are salivating to some extent, and they see these rich guys who can invest, and they're saying, well, I'd like to be part of this too, and I can't. On the other hand, some of that sounds a little like 1999, 2000,
right,
the build-up to the tech bubble. Everybody thinking, this is hot, everything's going up, I got to get in. I have to think Facebook and Goldman Sachs are not giving this stock and these interests away at some bargain
right,
price.
Exactly.
They're there to make money,
no deal,
too. So I'm not so sure people are missing out on the deal of a lifetime.
Okay, so it sounds like you're saying the sense of unfairness might be misplaced, unfounded, and somewhat irrational.
That's the way I look at it. But.
All right, we're going to have to leave it there, but thank you very much for sharing your insight with us today.
Well, thank you.
Now it's time for our Spotlight on Contributed Content. This is a segment where we highlight an article that was featured in one of our Bloomberg Law reports. Today's article comes to us from David Geffen and Joseph Fleming of Deckert. The title of the article is How the Dodd-Frank Act Should Affect Mutual Funds, Including Money Market Funds. In the article, the authors examine potential effects of future studies and regulations on funds and their advisors, and they describe exactly what the impact should be. You can find this article in the January 24th issue of our Bloomberg Law Reports, Securities Law, on the terminal at SCLRGO or at BloombergLaw.com. Articles are contributed to us for publication by practitioners, law professors, and other legal experts. To find out more about how you can contribute, please visit BloombergLaw.com. A special thank you to the Deckert authors for that contributed piece. And again, our thanks to Professor Merritt Fox of Columbia Law School.
Copyright 2011 Bloomberg Finance LP. All rights reserved. The views expressed herein are those of the speakers and not of Bloomberg Finance LP. These discussions are for informational purposes only and should not be construed as legal advice, which has to be addressed to particular facts and circumstances involved in any given situation. Bloomberg Finance LP and its affiliated entities do not take responsibility for the content contained herein and do not make any representation or warranty as to its completeness or accuracy.